Well,
once more under the breach, dear friend.
Yeah, let's close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. That wasn't a very enthusiastic
McClure. Yes, I mumbled my name.
Name mumbler, you.
Well, we've got exciting things to talk about this hour for The Personal Wealth Coach. Exciting for us.
Yes, very much exciting for us. Let's see, we can start off with some really good news.
I think it's let's hear it.
Economic news. It's one of the better pieces of economic news I've read recently, and it is that investors, according to the Wall Street Journal and according to a survey that was recently done, let's see who did the survey. Boston Consulting Group. Yes, the investors in the United States are the most bearish they have been since the Great Financial Crisis. Why is that good news? The more bearish investors are, the more room the stock market has to rise. And why is that true? Because when you survey people with a lot of money to invest, and they think the market's going to go down next year, go down in the near future, and we have a pretty high number that says the market, like 70%, of the investors that were surveyed said they think the market is overvalued and likely to fall. It's the 250 investors, collective $500 billion in assets. That's a big power in the market. Those people, by definition, have already sold and are justifying it, and they have cash that can be invested sitting in their coffers waiting for the market to make a dip. And when the market makes a dip, they jump in and buy. And that is why the market doesn't go down as long as there's a lot of people who are pessimistic. Now, if we ever get to the point where only 10% of the investors surveyed by the Boston Consulting Corporation company, the Boston Consulting Group, we're in for a big fall, because that means everybody is pretty much fully invested, which means that there's no money to speak of left to buy, and there's lots of money waiting to sell.
Basically, when everyone agrees it's a good time to buy, is a bad time to buy. So but that's a very nice time to sell. John Templeton said this: I believe in being a conscientious investor. When others wish to sell, I oblige them and buy. And when others wish in mass to sell or to buy, I oblige them and sell.
There's another piece of news that's kind of bad if you're a Harvard alumnus.
Yes.
A member of the alumni of Harvard, I guess.
Because you might be getting more requests for donations to your alma mater.
They hired a new Harvard endowment manager. And I don't know, those of you with really long memories can remember back in the two, when everybody else was doing poorly in investing.
The Yale and Harvard endowments were the poster children of the best way to invest.
Right. And
at the time, we had some comments on
the guy
that.
Who's lined up. Wasn't L. Orion at the Harvard? Was he at Yale?
He was at Yale.
Okay.
But same stuff. He bought a bunch of forest land, so it's the same thing.
And the issue is that apparently one of the major investments in the Harvard Endowment is a huge tract of eucalyptus forest somewhere in South America.
It's a very nice forest.
And they have been saying it's an extremely stable investment. It has
it hasn't moved at all. It's
value.
Been there the whole time.
Well, actually, it's risen in value slowly.
Well, the trees have risen slowly as well.
Yeah, and the problem is that they needed some cash rather than eucalyptus trees in South America.
It's really hard to spend eucalyptus trees.
And so they put it on the market and they kept lowering the price until they were down 50% and they didn't have any bidders. And they took it back off the market, and the manager said, we should probably cut the value of this property by 80%. And the board of directors at Harvard said, oh, no, that would cause us to look terrible. We're only going to cut it by 25%. So as they've gone through what's called alternative investments, and in case you get offered alternative investments, this is the kind of stuff.
They're generally not very liquid,
right,
which means they look really stable because they haven't traded very much lately. So you're just going on the last price that they did trade, which may have been a decade ago.
And so a lot of alternative investments look like they rise every year because what happens, and this has been going on with Harvard and with Yale, is they hire appraisers, local appraisers, to go in and appraise the value of the property based on some esoteric reason.
Right. So a South American eucalyptus forest appraiser showed up and said, yes, or see, this is the same forest I looked at before, and I would say it's worth more today than the last time I looked at it.
Please pay me more money than you paid me last year because I get a percentage of whatever I say it's worth.
Right.
And so each year it's been worth more. Now, I know Yale had a large piece, I don't know if they still have it, of yellow pine forests in East Texas, for example.
They had some problems with disease in their yellow pines, and a lot of them died.
There was a bug in the problem.
Yeah.
A lot of bugs in the problem.
One of the problems with alternative investing is that they could get diseases.
Yes, and as a result, but they are, by the way, I think, still carrying that forest land on the book at the original purchase price.
Yes.
Because the last time there was a purchase of land that large, they were the ones who made the purchase, and that sets the price.
Right.
You like that? Well, anyway.
When you own that many millions of acres, there are not that many people that just on a whim go out and buy millions of acres of anything.
And there are costs to maintaining these forest lands. You actually have to not let them burn down, and you have to patrol them, and you have to do a lot of things. And because these endowments are nonprofits, in most cases, they are exempt from local taxation, and that really makes it rough on the local community. So the local community doesn't provide anybody to patrol the property, and they insist that you do. Anyway, you might think, well, I'm not going to buy millions of acres of forest. But if you have in your portfolio, if you have an alt investment, you very well might inadvertently have a tiny share of millions of acres of forest, and you cannot sell a tiny – well, you can if somebody else is willing to buy it, but it's a greater fool theory. The point is you don't know what the forest is worth because there is no highly liquid market for it.
And this is something that should be understood without any quibbles. Forestry purchases are kind of like buying a 40-year bond, or in some cases a 100-year bond.
A 100-year non-traded bond.
Right. You cannot get any value for those trees until they are old enough to be cut down.
Right.
You still don't get value for those trees for the typical seasoning period of a cut down tree is about 1 year for every inch of width of the trunk. So 100-year-old tree, which you had to plant at some point 100 years ago, grows up, is finally cut down. Say it's 5 feet across. Well, you're talking about years of that thing sitting, waiting to be cut.
So we don't like alts, and that's why we don't like alts. And the reason is they make the portfolio look stable, and it's one of those things. It's kind of like If you have an annuity, a single premium deferred annuity with a 15-year surrender charge on it, and it's worth $100,000 according, or let's say it's worth $115,000.
The statement comes out and says that. So yeah.
It's worth $120,000 according to the statements. But if you try to get the money back out of there,
you
it's
only
really
get only 90.
Worth, it's only worth 90 or 100,000 because of the surrender charges. In other words, the money's there until you need it, and then it's not.
Which means that it's just imaginary. It's imaginary numbers.
Which is okay if you're a politician, but for the rest of us, it doesn't work.
It's really, really, really hard to eat imaginary food.
Anyway, so those are a couple of issues that, from our perspective, amount to good news, but they're not good news for some other people. You know, one, there's a lot of bears out there who believe...
On forest lands in alternate... No, different
yes,
kind of bears.
But there's a couple kind of things. Basically, we've made a bet against alts, and they're beginning to show their true nature. The other thing is that a lot of bearish attitudes towards with people who have a whole lot of money, and as long as that's in place, the markets have room to grow because there's a lot of money sitting on the side that once the market begins to move upward, we'll say, oh, we missed it, and jump in and buy.
Right.
So those are both. Then we got a lot of other things. You wanted to talk about the air coming out of the yield curve.
Yeah. The yield curve, what does that mean? People talk about the curve. It's not really that curvy. I've never actually seen the yield curve be curved.
It is. It's a little curved.
It's not really. There's too many bumps in it. It's not very curved. It's rough. But what it is the comparison between the 2-year and the 10-year treasury yields.
Or you could compare all the way out to 30 years.
Right. You could go out to 30 if you'd
right.
like. So here's the issue. When the interest rate on the 2-year treasury starts getting up into the same territory as the interest rate on the 10-year period, it's usually a precursor to bad times in the not overly distant future. However, you were going to say something. I'll let you say your piece, and then I'll step in and say my piece.
Well, you know, historically, the reason the long bond, if you go out longer, when the interest rates go down there, that's because basically we expect low economic activity in the long term. And when they get high in the short term, at the same time, you get what's called an inverted yield curve. What's the high in the short term means? That means that economic activity is going on really fast right now, but the bond market in its collective wisdom has concluded that future economic activity will be slower, and it's a self-fulfilling prophecy
when
we get a recession.
Can we get air quotes around the wisdom, the collective wisdom
well,
of the bond market?
Well, it is.
We do the air quote, wisdom.
Okay, but it
seems to work.
But this ain't thin, because that presumes that there's nothing but open market forces operating in the bond market. But right now, we have this little problem in that the 800-pound gorilla in the room in the United States, and for that matter around the world, our central banks. The Federal Reserve, for example, is the 800-pound gorilla. And what it's doing is raising – it has the ability to control short-term rates to raise them. And inadvertently, it's also depressing – not inadvertently, maybe vertently, I don't know – is depressing longer-term rates because it is putting more bonds on the market as it gradually sells down the trillions of bonds it bought during the recession period. And the more – bonds there are for sale in the longer maturities, the lower the price gets because there's a lot of supply in for the same amount of demand. So we could get, at this point, an inverted yield curve that means nothing. We're not close to an inverted yield curve yet, but it's flattening.
Which means that the shorter term is getting closer in the yields to the longer term. Mm-hmm. Back in the mid-2000s, there was a great speech that Alan Greenspan gave that I was in complete agreement with.
1994?
No, in the mid-2000s. 2005.
Oh,
okay. He said there's a conundrum going on.
Oh, I love it when conundrums go
right.
on.
The conundrum in the yield curve, he said, was based on the fact that the short-term interest rates were going up and the long-term interest rates were remaining flat. And he looked at it and he said in a speech that this appeared to be because many other government funds were purchasing the longer-term bonds of the United States, keeping their interest rates down. Because when a lot of people are wanting to loan us money, well, then we can afford, we can negotiate well to keep our interest rates down. So if there's a lot of this, just to get this right out there, if there's a lot of people wanting loans and not a lot of money to loan to them, interest rates go up. Because if you're the only one available to get a loan from, you're going to charge for it. But if you're competing with a lot of other people to give this loan, you've got to lower your interest rates. Well, at this point, a lot of governments were competing to loan money to the United States government, which kept the long-term interest rates low.
It's very complicated.
It is. Isn't that
you almost have to be a banker to understand it.
This whole concept, a lot of people wanted to give us money, so we didn't have to pay a lot for that money. While the short-term interest rates were going up because the Federal Reserve was raising interest rates that banks charge each other, and the so that was the competitive environment. Interest rates go up when competition's rates go up. Interest rates go down when competition rates go down. So that's just the way it works. He said it was a conundrum. He said that the yield curve may not be predictive this time. He said that he was not thinking that it had much to do with anything, except that those long-term rates were because a lot more money was also flowing into the mortgage market. With the loosening of the ability for investment banks to put money into commercial banks, a lot more money was available, which kept the interest rates really low and allowed a lot of people that couldn't afford to pay the loans the ability to do it.
Actually, it's the other way around. The regular banks were allowed to flow money into the commercial banks, the investment banks.
Right. They were able to sell their loans to the investment banks, who provided a lot of money to the commercial banks to buy more loans. So this new influx of money kept the rates really low. Interest rates were low because other governments were coming in. Today, we've got other issues that are also different this time, in that all the new loans for the U.S. government right now, we're not issuing 30-year bonds. Did you know that? Right now, we're not issuing 30-year bonds. We're issuing two-year bonds. We're issuing very, very short-term bonds, which if you're a banker, that should make you laugh with great amusement. If you're not a banker, you might on the surface say, why is that funny? Because the government is making a lot of effort at a time when interest rates are historically extremely low to not lock in the debt at the low rate for a long time, but rather to do it for short periods of time.
And it is a big political issue. There's some points I agree and some points I disagree with the Secretary of the Treasury.
Which just means that all the new loans that we're making right now, when we're talking about the new tax bill, we're talking about the deficit we're running this year and last year and the year before, all of those new loans were at short-term rates, which means we have to renew them probably at higher interest rates in the not-too-far-distant future.
What I was trying to say is Secretary Mnuchin tried really hard to put the Treasury in a position where it was going to borrow money long-term.
Right, which is very brilliant.
Very, very low rates.
It's very smart. It's what Apple's doing.
And the senior members of the administration, which I presume include the president, blocked him and said, don't you do it. We're not going to allow you to do it. And the reason is
it looks bad.
Well, what happened is if you go out to long-term borrowing, it's higher interest than short-term borrowing right now, but it's much lower interest than it's going to be in the future. And so what it would do is it would run up the interest payments
on the
projected
debt.
On the debt. Because when we project interest payments, we presume, for instance, if we borrow 2 years at tiny, tiny percentages, that it will always stay 2 years at tiny, tiny percentages, which is wrong. But I haven't agreed with the Secretary of the Treasury. I think if he had been allowed to do that, we'd have been better off in the future. But he wasn't, so that's beside the point.
Right. And this is one of those things that economists, bankers look at this and say, well, if you're going to get a loan, you should do it at a long-term rate as low as you can, that you can pay off, particularly if you're still spending more than you're making. And we are. So looking at that, you can see why short-term rates are coming up. The Federal Reserve is doing it, and the new loans going out there. All the Federal Reserve is raising rates while the new loans for the government are in the short term. So it's causing interest rates in the short term to come up while the longer term rates are kind of flat. We had some boosts earlier in the year, but they're not, they've been flat for a while. What that means is we're not inverted. We're not in a place where we could say danger signs, but it's getting closer together. And when that happens, when we see those rates getting closer together, it's because the bond market doesn't see the kind of growth in the long term that it sees in the short term. Whether or not that's right is a big question, but I'm not ready to say it's wrong. Janet Yellen is saying it may not be right this time, but Alan Greenspan said it may not have been right, and he said that in 2006. If we just hung around a year and a half later, it caused a lot of egg on our face. The time before that was in 1999, 2000 hit. So we're seeing some signs. We're not inverted yet. It may not happen at all. It may be that long-term rates are going to pick up, but either way you look at it, we've got some commercials to play. So we're going to play these commercials, and we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to call in, we've got telephones in here, 773-1400. That's 254-773-1400. And we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach.
254-773-1400. And it looks like we're getting a call on 773-1400. So, caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I just wanted to make a suggestion to you two old boys there. You know, instead of wasting your time being out here on this radio program, you need to run for office in a government office and straight this economy out. And if you do take my suggestion, you be sure you take your boat and a lot of cleaning equipment in case they do decide to drain that swamp. But, yeah, man, I'm just making a little joke to y'all. But bless both of you, and y'all have a Merry Christmas, sir. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the call.
I hope they don't drain the swamp.
Why would you say that?
Well, this is what happens when you drain a swamp. And the Everglades, they've discovered this much to their chagrin and a lot of other places. It's now illegal in the United States to drain swamps in most cases. And there's a reason for that. When it rains, you get a lot of rain. The swamp retains the water and slowly lets it out over time so you don't get a flood. During dry periods, the swamp continues to release water long after the rain has stopped. And the issue of, and again, this is my geeky way of looking at it, draining the swamp is, generally speaking, a pretty bad idea. There's a reason that all the bureaucracy and all of the positions and all the counterbalances are put into effect in our government. And obviously, from at least from the perspective of the president, it's pretty clear he considers the courts to be part of the swamp, the legislature to be part of the swamp. He wants to rush to get things done, and we get a flood as a result. There's a reason that the Tax Reform Act of 1986, the last reform of the tax law, took 2 years and worked pretty well, and worked pretty well for a long time. And that's because it filtered through an awful lot of swamp and got rid of a lot of stuff that wasn't supposed to be there. Now, admittedly, a lot has been added in since then, and it is time to do it again because times have changed and the economy has changed. It's definitely time to do it again. But the concept of draining the swamp, in my humble opinion, is a very, very bad idea, and it is a really good reason that we've stopped allowing swamps to be drained. And if somebody decides to drain a swamp, they have to put in something the equivalent of a swamp to hold the water from rushing out.
You may be taking this a little literally. That, yeah. Let me kind of approach the way the attempt is being made to get rid of the overhead in Washington right now. It's not targeted. You're not saying, we're not going across and saying we don't like this program or we like that program and we're going to take funding away from this and keep it at this other place. It's being drained by neglect. It's just not replacing funding for everybody. And it's this method started with sequestration. which was a bipartisan thing. So there's no real good, easy way of blaming anybody on this. It was the Democrats and the Republicans. They had to agree on a bill, so they did sequestration, which just kind of unilaterally cut from the budget across the board, and the Congress didn't have to make a decision about what they were cutting, so they didn't have to take the blame for cutting a specific program. They could just shrug their shoulders and say, well, I didn't make that decision. How did that happen? What can we do about it? But
it must be the other party's
fault. Must be the other party's fault.
Because my party didn't do that.
We left an out for both sides. We're still draining the swamp by neglect rather than saying, let's carefully shore up this position. Like the IRS. I don't know anybody that thinks the IRS is a wonderful, warm, and caring group of people that everyone should love. But without them, we don't get revenue to the government. So if I don't want the IRS to be a bunch of attack dogs going out and attacking people that aren't being bad. That's the fear that we all have, is that somehow the IRS is going to show up and seize money that doesn't belong to them. They've done it in the past. They've done it a lot in the past. But at the same time, we need a functional IRS, or we don't have roads. We don't have a military. We don't have Social Security, and so on. So the middle ground has been, all right, let's cut back on the watchdog status. Let's make the attack dog less. But we can't get that passed into bills. So instead, we slowly lower the budget. And then in the middle of that, we just don't replace anybody that's leaving. So if they resign or retire, no replacement comes in. Well, that's a long-term weakness, not a strength. If we could say, this is how we want the IRS to function, well, that's the job of Congress. They can say, this is how we want them to function. Here are the parameters they need to follow so that they're not attacking good people. Instead, we say, sometimes they attack good people, so none of them get money. And don't be surprised with the complexity of the new law if it takes a long time for the IRS to write the regulations to figure out how much you should have withheld from your paycheck. It may be June before we figure out what we're supposed to do.
And I don't think they'll have it by June.
It's because we're draining the swamp. We're just not doing it strategically. We're doing it haphazardly, lackadaisically. We don't have to do anything and it'll drain itself. Well, that's not how it works.
If you want to put a road through the swamp because you need to get from one place to another and you put adequate bridges in and things like that, that makes sense. That's infrastructure. Draining the swamp per se is a bad idea. And I think that's what we're in agreement upon. And fundamentally, it takes a lot of effort and a lot of planning to reform in any organization the size of the federal government. And for instance, the Department of Education has got a lot of money that's funded for the Department of Education to equalize education levels across the United States so that people living in really, really, really poor areas or in areas that have very low tax base because the federal government owns a lot of land. There's a lot of reasons that we passed education bills to sort of, but not actually, equalize funding so that, for instance, in Massachusetts and Connecticut, the dollars spent per child are about four times what they are in Texas. And so equalizing that a little bit helps tremendously. But right now, all the undersecretaries of education just aren't there because the Trump administration, I guess in the name of draining the swamp, has not nominated anybody for those positions. And as a result, the programs that need updating and need changing and need fixing, and the law's even there that allows them to fix the program, but there's nobody there to fix it. It's kind of like, you know, when Governor White a long time ago froze the budget of the state of Texas what he said was, anybody that retires, we won't fill the slot. We have a hiring freeze. And I don't know if you remember this, the guy who wrote a letter, which tells you how long ago, wrote a letter to the governor and says, I'm retiring. I run the Port Aransas drawbridge. Do you want me to leave it up or down?
Right. Well, we've got to play some more commercials this hour. We'll be back on the other side. We'll talk more about entitlements. We'll talk more about what does the tax plan mean for us and talk about some good news, because we've been kind of harping on Congress and bad and all of that good stuff. But we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to call in and join us, the number in here is 254-773-1400. We'll be back.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. So
we've got about a little over 15 minutes left. Oh, we've got a call coming in. We've got lots of stuff to talk about, but we'll get the caller on the air. Caller on 773-1400, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, this is Robert. And your first hour conversation, I just have to call and clear up a common misconception. And that misconception is under the Reagan Tax Act, the 86 law.
Yes.
That he created more revenue.
No, he didn't. No.
But the story that we always hear is that the tax, the balance, the budget was balanced because of his tax law.
No, no. Yeah, you're correct. You are absolutely correct there in that that is a story that gets passed around. But if you just look at the numbers, it's not the case.
It actually was a revenue neutral. The 86 tax law was revenue neutral.
But it was not, because in 87, his then Treasury Secretary Baker, I believe it was, comes to him and says, "We're not going to cut it, guy. We need to do something to make the budget funds look better." And they went out and sold $700 million of perfectly good Farmers Home debt.
Sure.
To make that happen. And they did the exact same thing the next year.
Yeah, but when the bill was passed, it was intended to be revenue neutral.
And it was, but the spending went up right afterwards. So.
Yeah, and they, you're correct. But notably in this tax bill, by the way, we didn't talk about this. Part of the bill includes selling oil 5 years from now from the Strategic Reserve. Selling leases that are supposed to generate $1 billion in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which, by the way, nobody that I've read suggests will generate $1 billion.
Yeah, in current situation, fracking is more profitable than setting up infrastructure way up in Alaska.
Every time a bill does. Now, what happened is the 1982 version of the bill that was passed by the Economic Recovery Act of 1982, which changed the tax law, was a big net loser to the government, and they recognized that. In 1986, the intention of the Tax Reform Act of 86 was to be revenue neutral. Nothing's perfect. And so the Technical Correction Act that comes – which we'll get one in 2018, I assure you, will come in and say this is not working. But this particular bill – is not passed with the intent of being revenue neutral. As a matter of fact, they consciously say it's going to cost $1.4 trillion.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, if it's extended, it'll cost a lot more. And that's – so there's a difference between a bill with that the Congressional Budget Office, which didn't exist at the time, but the Joint Committee on Taxation and the Treasury number crunchers all agree, okay, this is probably revenue neutral versus one – that's passed that says we're going to cut everybody's taxes and it's not revenue neutral. We're going to increase deficits a whole bunch down the road.
At the same time that we're increasing spending.
Right.
Which is what is going on. there's a bunch of kids in the candy shop. That's what's happening. And they just got control of the prices.
And, you know, and frankly, will that increased deficit blow us up? I don't think so. But it does complicate things going forward, and it's contradictory to some of the things that have been said in the past by the same people
right.
who are passing this bill.
And you're absolutely right in that a lot of people, and I've heard this Congress folks recently talking about the 1986 bill, which simplified and raised revenue, and I hear that all over the place. You're absolutely correct. It did not raise revenue. It didn't lower revenue, but they then increased spending, which caused the deficit to go way up.
And Jake mentioned this last hour, and it's not a very popular thing to say.
No, thank you.
But the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, did increase revenues to the federal government, which is a strong indicator that the people who were hit by the surcharge, the upper income people hit by the surcharge, just kept spending. They didn't care that they were taxed more.
There's two places where the revenue went up, by the way, in the Affordable Care Act. And we call it Obamacare, Affordable Care Act. I don't care what they call it. It's whatever you feel like calling it, you can call it that. You can even call it expletives, just not on the air. The whole concept is that you raise the money for the insurance by having an individual mandate and then a surcharge on the more wealthy. So that's what happened. Revenue went up there, and then we had a hidden boost thanks to the Republican states not expanding Medicaid in their states, including Texas. The tax was still there. If you are a couple and you make more than $250,000 in the state of Texas, you're paying 3% on top of the other taxes. It's going off to the government. It's supposed to come back to the state to help the expansion of Medicaid, but the state of Texas has said we don't want it. So the federal government gets to spend that on what they want. So there's like a hidden unintended boost to the government, which that's just politics. Politics is so – I feel – when people say you should run for office, I'm like, there's not enough soap in the world to make me feel clean after running for office.
And on the issue of deficits, since we're talking about deficits, there's a really good study I read I read an article about the study that made a lot of sense. And it says basically deficits don't count unless inflation goes up. In other words, if the government is spending more money than it's taking in, it's putting more money into this money supply effectively, as long as we don't have any significant inflation.
That's great.
Then that was money we needed in the money supply to make things work. Now, when the government starts spending a lot of money that it's not taking in.
All of the 1970s.
Right, and inflation goes up at the same time, and then you've got a serious problem. But as long as there's little or no inflation, the Federal Reserve is looking out there and saying we need more inflation, even as they raise interest rates. But
I have to give a compliment to the caller.
Right.
Your knowledge on an esoteric area of not just taxes but revenue from taxes, it's pretty fantastic.
You
so
must have a long memory. That's all I got to say. Thank you for calling.
You know, it just irritates me that the Reagan tax cuts are going down in history as a balanced event, and it just wasn't. It was close, but no cigar.
Right. Well, they really weren't. The Tax Reform Act of 86 was really not a tax cut. Now, the Tax Reform Act, the one that the Economic Recovery Act of 82, which was a tax bill, was a tax cut with the intent of stimulating the economy. It did in real estate.
This is where George H.W. Bush called Reagan, what was it,
voodoo economics? Voodoo economics, yeah. And it did. It generated a big boom or bubble, as the case may be, in real estate, the Economic Recovery Act of 82. And the 86 popped the bubble, and in 87 we got a market crash. So that was always interesting. Those things all go together. Well, thank you for calling, sir.
Yes, appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
All right. Speaking of bubbles, may I talk about bubbles for a minute?
Only if it's not with gum.
Okay. Barron's has a really good article in today's magazine about bubbles and how to spot a bubble. And
I like bubble wrap. It's really fun.
But you like to pop it, and
like
then it's gone.
It.
Well,
I also like to wrap things with it, but popping it is really, really satisfying.
And the writer of the article, who's Ben Levinson, who's really an insightful
– I think it's Levinson. Does he have a T in there?
No, there's no N in there. There's no T and there's no N. It's Levison.
Levison, okay.
He writes a lot of the articles that I've discovered that I every time he writes something, it works out. Trader. He writes The Trader and some other things. But, you know, he had a really interesting thing. He says, people are calling the stock market a bubble now, but it isn't. It doesn't meet the criteria. And there's why. He said, we have a clear example of a bubble. Bitcoin is up 1,700% this year. And if you had now there's other similar things that are not quite that much, but have done it. 1979 silver did this. 1979 and 80. It took 2 years for the bubble to pop. There was a tulip mania that did the same thing in 1637. There's a lot of these things that have gone on, but here's an indication when you got a bubble. And we had one in the 90s, for example. Riot Blockchain, which has absolutely nothing to do with blockchain or with Bitcoin, gained 730% this year. It surged from $8 to $28.50 after changing its name from Riot to Riot Blockchain. All they put anywhere was blockchain. They have absolutely nothing to do with Bitcoin.
There were a bunch of folks that did that in the late 90s. They just added .com. They didn't do anything extra. They made a website for themselves, but they just added .com to their company name, and suddenly their price went up.
So here's how to know. And we've had some. I've had some questions about this. And the bears, there's still, which is a good sign. There's still bears out there. They believe that the stock market is overpriced. And here's how you do it: the S&P 500 is trading at 22.5 times historic earnings.
So the trailing earnings, yeah, earnings trailing that earnings. They've already had
mm-hmm. over the last several years. And I love a lesser on estimated earnings going forward, about 17 or 18. Times.
Because they expect to be making more in the future.
Even if you go with the conservative side, which is trailing earnings, which we know happen, that there's nothing's going to change that, then the earnings yield of the Standard Poor's 500 stock index is 4.4%. Now, compare that to the 10-year bond. The chances of making money in the stock market and the chances of making money on a 10-year bond are almost identical if you hold the 10-year bond to maturity. In other words,
which
you put
means we're fairly priced.
Right. When you put a 10-year horizon out there, so the
but
earnings
it doesn't
yield,
mean we're underpriced anymore.
Right, we're pretty fairly priced, right? The point is the earnings yield of the S&P 500 is 4.4 and the 10-year bond is 2.36. So you have almost twice the yield in the S&P 500 with a distinct possibility of the price going up, whereas in a bond you have a guarantee that if you bought it at $1,000, you will sell it at $1,000 minus inflation.
The guarantee is based on the guarantor. If that's the government, then you've got a pretty good likely chance there. If it's somebody that's just put blockchain in their name, I wouldn't buy that bond with that guarantee.
So we're not in a – that's one of the things I want to point out. We are not in a stock market bubble. There is a bubble, in my opinion.
There's some bond bubble. There's some stock bubble.
Right. With Bitcoin, there's a distinct bubble. I've been saying that bonds are overpriced for a long time, and they're still remained overpriced, and they've even gotten more overpriced. Stocks did that in the 1990s. At some point – interest rates will start to go back up again because they are artificially low. And at that point, we're going to see some interesting things occur, and we think a lot about that.
And when we say at some point, it's really easy to look at what that point will be. When the recovery doesn't need life support across Europe, and we're getting close to that point, then the European Central Bank won't be pumping money in. The Japanese Central Bank won't be pumping money in. That's going to cause interest rates to start going up. There's less money to loan. When there's less money to loan, interest rates go up.
And by the way, another article I think makes a lot of sense in Barron's today. No, it was in the Wall Street Journal. The tax overhaul that we see – The tax overhaul that we see going on is going to affect overseas holdings of American corporations. Basically, we're going to hit them with a one-time tax of 15% on liquid positions that they hold overseas and 8% on illiquid positions. And then they can bring it back once they're going to pay the tax either way.
Yeah, they have to pay. It doesn't matter if they bring it back or not. They're going to get hit with the tax.
So once they pay the tax, they can bring it back for free. We did this in 1994, almost identical. We put a tax holiday on overseas holdings of U.S. corporations so they could bring the cash back to the United States. They did bring cash, massive amounts of cash back to the United States. But here's the key. They didn't hire anybody. They actually used the cash
to buy back shares,
to lay off people,
to give dividends,
right,
and to lay people off.
And so what they did is they did big share buybacks, as Jake said, they paid dividends, and they invested in their own company to increase productivity. And they did mergers and acquisitions with it.
This is a big chunk of the tax bill that's just passed, a huge chunk, so we're going to have to spend some time reading it. But it looks like we're going to a territorial tax system, which means that we're not going to charge companies in Germany that are American companies for what they build in Germany, what they profit in Germany. That may have big implications later on down the road. But right now, we get to – it's kind of like no amnesty. So we're saying, okay, now you're into the territorial system, but all the taxes that you owe on the money that you've already made, we're going to say you got to pay this now. Most of the money that Google, Alphabet, Apple, Facebook, all of them have overseas is in illiquid positions at this point. They're not sitting in cash. The big headlines say they've got trillions of cash or whatever. That's not the case. It's in illiquid positions. So look at that lower interest, the 8.8% tax on that. And we're about out of time. Do you want to wrap up some?
Stock market was up. Probably going to go up some more. Probably be up by the end of the year. The tax code, the new tax law is probably going to pass. And it's we're going to find out unexpected things about it, and there'll be a fix next year. But 2018 is starting to look more and more like a pretty good year, at least the first half of it, for the economy and for the markets.
So if you would like to contact us off the air, we do give investment advice to individuals. So instead of just educating, we do that as well. We also give advice on how to invest. You can call us locally. We've got voicemail waiting at
254-947-1111.
You can reach that toll free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. There we've got philosophy, newsletters, podcasts, all that great stuff.
And you can see our made for radio faces.
Yes, and please don't break your computer in the process. We will talk to you next week. This has been The Personal Wealth Coach.